This is episode 51 of the Fifth Estate Podcast, Senator Ben Sasse and the Vanishing American Adult.
Hey there, Fifth Estate fans. Neil Doing here to tell you about our friends at Dollar Shave Club, the smarter choice. Folks, when you order from Dollar Shave Club, you will get a great shave at a great price, conveniently delivered right to your door. It's really a no-brainer. No longer do you have to schlep to the store to buy a cheap disposable razor that gives you a cheap shave. Neither do you have to spend a fortune on razors with gimmicky shaving tech that you don't need. I myself use the Dollar Shave Club Executive Razor with their Dr. Carver's Shave Butter. And let me tell you, folks, the blade glides ever so gently and gives me such a smooth shave. No foolin'. Plus, the Dr. Carver's Shave Butter is transparent for a more precise shave. It helps prevent ingrown hairs and fights razor bumps. Now, listeners to the Fifth Estate can make the smarter choice by joining Dollar Shave Club for a limited time. New members get their first month of the Executive Razor with a tube of their Dr. Carver's Shave Butter for only $5 with free shipping. After that, razors are just a few bucks a month. That's a $15 value for only $5. In your first month box, you get an awesome weighty handle, a full cassette of four cartridges, and a tube of their Shave Butter. After your first month, replacement cartridges ship automatically at their regular price. There are no hidden fees. There are no commitments. You can cancel anytime you like. And you can only get this offer exclusively at dollarshaveclub.com/fifth. That's dollarshaveclub.com/fifth.
All right, it is time for another episode of the Fifth Estate. I'm Jay Caruso, your co-host, along here with Mr. Neil Doing. How are you, sir?
I'm doing great, Jay. Doing great. How are you?
All right. Hey, you've heard of the, you've probably heard this term, adulting, right? Have you heard that before?
Yeah, not a fan.
Yeah, I'm not a fan either. It's one of those, you know, as a Generation Xer, I get to incessantly mock it, you know, because it's a kind of, I think it's a millennial thing, I think.
Well,
anyway.
As a millennial, I'm embarrassed a little bit by it. So.
Well, interestingly enough, and before we get into it, of course, we tell everybody, you know, we love having you as listeners. Please go out. Leave a review of this podcast, especially this one. This one's going to be a good one. And, you know, subscribe, everybody.
It would be the grown-up thing to do.
Absolutely. And no one needs to tell you how to do it. You should be able to just go to iTunes and figure it out on your own. Just kind of click around. You'll see. It's not hard. So, but interestingly enough, the whole idea about adulting and you know, what it means to be an adult and, you know, getting preparing yourself and preparing your life as an adult. We have our guest wrote a book about this, and it's not really much of a how-to book. I don't think anybody's going to, you know, I think he may agree. It's not, you know, this is not a blueprint for how to live your life, but it's more just kind of him talking about his own experiences, his own stories. And so we have brought aboard Nebraska Senator Ben Sasse to talk about his book, The Vanishing American Adult, Our Coming-of-Age Crisis, and How to Rebuild a Culture of Self-Reliance. Senator, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for the invite. Good to be here.
So, Senator, tell us, just kind of give us some background. What made you decide, you know, because, I mean, let's face it, politicians, when they write books, it's usually, you know, kind of like wave the flag, you know, rah, 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 this is what I believe in, all this other kind of thing. And you kind of went in a totally different direction. Which I think is great. So kind of give us what made you think about this and decide, you know what, I think I'm going to write a book about this.
Yeah, well, first of all, I wouldn't want to write a book that I wouldn't want to read. You know, I wouldn't want to write something that I wouldn't be able to, in good faith, try to persuade other people to read. And a lot of those kind of, that genre of politician book you're talking about doesn't interest me very much. I don't read them. And I mean, maybe it's because I have a little bit of a life experience that's different, in that I think I'm one of five people in the Senate who's never been a politician before. I've never run for any office before until I was elected to the Senate. And so this book doesn't really originate out of my public office. It comes much more from the fact that I was a college president for 5 years before I ran for Senate. I was a business turnaround guy before that, but then I spent 5 years leading a college. And no one hired me to help turn around this 130-year-old school because I was supposedly an expert in student affairs or student life. And yet that's the thing that really kept me up at night when I was at the college, is seeing the experience of our incoming students. And I want to be clear, this is meant to be a constructive project. This is not a blame-laying book. If I were laying blame, I'd be laying it at the feet of, you know, we the parents and we the grandparents, not at today's teens and 20-somethings. But I think that we're not having a very intentional conversation with kids coming of age about how and why we should be celebrating scar tissue. Our kids are mostly coming up in an environment where they've been insulated from work. Again, this is not an argument that millennials or teens or early 20-somethings are lazy. This is that they live in a unique moment in economic history, and they have an experience that's really different than what habit formation has looked like for most peoples in times past. And I think we need to do better by kids than we're doing right now. And so this book is an attempt to wrestle with that broader cultural conversation.
Yeah, Senator, I think that's it's a familiar kind of dilemma for a lot of people who have seen this and aren't quite sure how to go about addressing it. They know there's a problem. They know there's something that needs to be addressed. But when you have, there's a risk of sounding like a crank when you start to complain about the youths, right? And I think one of the things that your book accomplishes is avoiding sounding like a crank. So it's sort of this grounding that you have. With your background in education and the real world experience that you have, tell us a little bit more about like the specific things that you see going on with young people and what's holding them back.
Yeah. So first of all, this book hopefully has no old man get off my lawn screaming in it. That's not the project. 2/3 of this book is sort of constructive. What kind of habits do we want our teens to form, and what would it look like to have an institutional architecture to their coming of age years that tried to advance that kind of habit formation? So stuff like becoming actually literate, not just functionally literate. What have you wanted to read? What do you read? How do you do it habitually? What does it look like to travel? Not grand European tour for rich people, but what does it look like to actually live in different communities or to go and spend time out in nature such that you get a fresh pair of eyes so you can look back and see where you're from? There's that old adage that a fish isn't very good at explaining to you what water's like because he's never been out of water. When you travel and live in a different community or live with different people, you all of a sudden acquire eyes that aren't just about the new place, but they're about the place that you're contrasting it with. It's about work ethic. It's about limiting your consumption and being aware of the distinction between needs and wants. It's about having intergenerational experiences, because that's a pretty weird thing about the way we raise kids now, that 17-year-olds tend to live almost all of their life with 17-year-olds. No one else in human history has ever really done that. That's weird. And so I try to lay this against the backdrop of what is adolescence, because adolescence is a good thing. This book's boogeyman, or what this book's scared about, is perpetual adolescence, which is a completely new concept. But adolescence itself isn't really that old. It's only about 2 millennia old, this idea that when you hit puberty, when you hit biological adulthood, you don't immediately have to be a fully formed, independent person in terms of your moral independence, your emotional independence, your financial independence, school leaving, household formation. We have this kind of weird idea that your body becomes an adult, and yet you still get another 18 months to 4 years of kind of greenhouse phase where you don't yet have to transition from the dependent state of childhood to the fully independent state of adulthood. That's great, as long as we recognize that adolescence is meant to be a means to an end. It is a transitional state. It's not supposed to be the destination. Peter Pan is a dystopian hell. It's not. Disney has tried to, you know, Disney tried to remake Peter Pan like it's the place that you want to live forever. But they did a really crappy job, because when you actually go read the original Peter Pan, this guy's physically an adult and he's killing people, and yet he has no historical memory. He has no moral sense. He doesn't know the names of the people he kills. He doesn't remember. He just sort of laughs it off. It's a really terrible thing to be truly an adult and still live like a child. And yet, right now, we're not helping kids as they come of age understand those kind of markers of transitioning to independent adulthood. 10 versus 15 years old versus 20 years old versus 25 years old. Those things should look different from one another, and right now they don't. And that's kind of we the adults' problem more than it's the kids' fault.
Right, and Senator, you talk about that a little bit, especially with education. There are people who are advocating a P through 16 educational model, which kind of like does this thing where, you know, there's like supposedly this kind of seamless trajectory from preschool all the way through college, because, you know, we seem to think that, you know, the argument is that, you know, kids who are just, you know, who are graduating from high school, we're just sending them off to college, and they're not really prepared to do that. But you say that that is not necessarily a way we should go. Is that correct?
Right. So the book is 100% not about politics, and I like to say it's 99% not about policy, but this is one of the places where it is a little bit about policy. About 40 out of 50 governors now are renaming their old K-12 or kindergarten through 12th grade bureaucracy something like P-16. So preschool instead of kindergarten, that flags a whole bunch of important debates about early childhood literacy and interventions for kids who are struggling. That's an important debate, but well outside the bounds of this. The grade 13 to 16 concept, I think, is just a disastrously bad idea, because what's happening is we're implying that social promotion through school, which is the main way that most kids think about their work right now as a 12-year-old or a 14-year-old or a 16-year-old, that's new. Most people in human history have had a distinction between production and consumption, between productive activities and things where you're on the sort of consumer end of an equation. And right now, our kids tend to think about time spent in school progressing through years and grades, and then their time outside of school is just different types of consumption. Well, you know, I think there's a lot to be said for mass secondary education. It's on net a benefit, but it's a mixed blessing to sort of say that 9th graders and 10th graders and 11th graders and 12th graders should spend the majority of their waking hours Monday through Friday in a kind of sedentary posture indoors, passively learning from a teacher in the front of the room. Again, I think there's lots of benefits to it, but we should be able to ask hard questions about at what point do you flip that room a little bit and make the student the one who's the active, curious, demanding, inquisitive learner who wants you to throw open the doors to a library and the experiences of field trips and work experience. There's a moment at which you need to become the active learner yourself, and it's a really bad idea, I think, to perpetuate the passive model of learning beyond grades, you know, 12, beyond age 18, and start to think about remaking college on a high school model. I think it'd be much more useful for us to have big plural debates about institutional forms for college that have lots of different ways that they're arranged, and then make that debate crowd down into high school. We should yearn to see 11th graders acting more like college freshmen and sophomores, not college sophomores acting more like 11th graders.
Right. And so that brings up a question about, you know, and again, you know, so the book isn't political, but I mean, talking about, you know, school and Senator, you and I are about the same age. So we had a discussion with Mike Rowe about this and the whole idea of, you know, a trade being something that, you know, people should be introduced to, especially students. And then you talked about that. You just touched upon that, saying, you know, if it's this entire passive education where you're just sitting there listening to somebody in the front of the class talking about something, you're not actually doing something that, you know, maybe we're kind of holding kids back who would be better at something else, particularly like a trade, electrician or a welder or something like that. So, you know, it comes back to the question you mentioned. You talked about this briefly with respect to homeschooling and everything. I don't know if you know who Sir Ken Robinson is. He talked about changing education paradigms. And, you know, is there any kind of flexibility with that from what you've dealt with to kind of change that around to get back to an educational system that is more open instead of everything being standardized. I think that's kind of like what we've gotten to a place where everything should be standardized instead of allowing education to be a little bit more free and open for kids to learn different things.
Yeah, well said. So first of all, Mike Rowe, I often joke that he's the model for how I want to be a U.S. senator. When people ask, you know, what do you think, who are you trying to emulate in the Senate in the way you're tackling this job? And I say, I don't think this institution's nearly interesting enough right now. If Mike Rowe were in the U.S. Senate and he were sort of the celebrant of the American work ethic, that's the kind of guy I want to be. And so it was a lot of fun that Mike Rowe is one of the guys who endorsed The Vanishing American Adult when it first came out. So I think that's a really helpful way to think about means and ends, which is school is a tool. And you know, I'm a son of a Nebraska public high school teacher and football and wrestling coach, and my wife's been a public high school teacher, and I'm a product of Nebraska high schools, public schools. So there's a lot to be said that I want to clearly affirm the American educational investment that we make. And yet, we should have a much more plural sense of what we're trying to accomplish, because right now, I don't think Americans have a sense of how recent this model is of putting 14 to 18-year-olds inside the majority of their time. You know, this is a model that really only came to flower from the 1920s to 1940s, as recently as the end of the Civil War. Less than 2% of Americans were high school graduates. Right. Most 14-year-olds have been engaged in productive work in the world. And I think that the secondary school model is, again, a benefit, but a mixed benefit. And we should understand that what you want is students to become curious enough that they demand things of the tool that is school. They want to use the tool, but they're not constrained by this one homogenized form, because kids are much more like plants than they're like cogs going through an assembly line. And the American high school was really built intentionally on an assembly line model during industrialization. And really, plants thrive and flourish and grow toward the sun and become big and strong with a whole bunch of different kinds of inputs. And I think that it would be really useful for us to be able to break the mental paradigm of a one-size homogenized model for schooling. And the good news is, I do think that that pluralization is coming. I just don't think it's going to come from policymakers. I think it's going to come first from technology. I think Saul Kahn and the Khan Academy, K-H-A-N, for folks who don't know what Saul Kahn is doing, he's one of the most interesting people in American education right now, but he's not really a traditional American educator. He's kind of a private equity guy who started using YouTube as a way to upload algebra videos that are 9 and 12 minutes in length to his niece who was struggling, and all of a sudden 3 million people were watching each of his videos, and he's become the most influential math teacher in the history of the world, not math researcher, but as a teacher. Lots and lots of American kids are learning from Saul Kahn and the Gates Foundation and other people who now fund his project. I think you're going to see lots of hybridization of American education, because technology is going to crowd in and American families and American students are going to demand more. And that's necessarily going to lead to a flourishing marketplace that's more interesting than the one homogenized model that American politics gives us.
Senator, I wanted to talk about a little bit about like hard work. You know, one of the things we also talked about with Mike Rowe, and one of the things that he noted was this sort of aversion to risk, including the risk of things like moving for a job, you know, for a job opportunity. And this aversion, I've noticed it, tends to show up in other areas of life, like deferring getting a driver's license. You know, I'm on the older side of millennials, but when I was 16, driver's license, yes, 16 in a day, bam, I've got it. But, you know, some of the younger kids, they put it off. They just don't see a need to get it. And what's that about? So what I think we're talking about with your book is sort of an active program of instilling and building character in people. And that's very tricky. You know, how do we do things like cultivate a work ethic and that sort of thing in your opinion?
Yeah, great question. There's so much meat in there. One thing about driving, and then let's get to the active program, because I really appreciate your modifier, active, because that is what I'm trying to do with this project. But where I'm from, out in rural Nebraska, you can get your driver's license at 14. You have to live 5 miles
from
school, and then you can drive at 14 instead of 16. And so when I was a kid, I got my driver's license at 13 and 10 months back then. Now you have to be 14 in a day. But my oldest kid is pushing age 16 now, but she's been driving for over 2 years. And my younger two, a 13-year-old and a 6-year-old, we go out to some hunting ground where we hunt, And, you know, they want to get behind the wheel of the truck. Like, they want to experiment with this because this is a tool that they want to learn how to manipulate and control.
Right.
This is beyond the reach of government. We're on a private hunting ground here. You know, and my kids, they want to learn, but you have to help inculcate in them a willingness to take some controlled risks. And this is what we mean at our house by celebrating scar tissue. Like, when our kids need stitches, if they don't hurt their neck, and they're not going to have any permanent damage, permanent paralysis, we think we got away with something because they're now internalizing a feedback loop about risk. We don't want to celebrate sort of rote markers. Everybody goes through the turning of the clock every 365 days. And it's great to celebrate the, you know, the human dignity of all of our kids. And it's fine to celebrate a birthday, but it's not an achievement. But an achievement is to figure out, you know, when you can jump off that roof and not get hurt. You know, figure out how to not break your ankle jumping off that roof. And I think we do need to inculcate more of an understanding in our kids that scar tissue is the foundation of future character. And in a republic, we need to basically have our kids understand that we don't think compulsion is the center of life. We don't think government is the center of life. We think persuasion is. And your affections and your loves and the things that you want to do and you want to do with other people. There is a difference between actually climbing a mountain and just seeing pictures from the top of a mountain your friend climbed on Instagram. And right now, I think a lot of the passivity that we're seeing with teens not all that interested in getting their driver's license is because I do think our digital addictions are kind of creating a world where passivity seems more normal. Lots of data showing teenage boys who, instead of going out on a big hunt anymore, think that sort of sitting still and going on a hunt on a video game is sort of a substitute activity. And I want to be clear, as I was writing this book and doing some research, I became slightly less skeptical of gaming than I used to be as I tried to understand it better and the roles that it serves for people. But I don't think there's any doubt that the total consumption data of how much video games our kids are playing, or just the absolutely spiking porn consumption numbers since 2007 in the U.S., I think those things are really, really dangerous, and we're not talking enough about the way the digital world is, instead of supplementing a physical world, it's often supplanting it, and that is not going to build the kind of virtue we're talking about.
Fascinating. And I think in your book, you lay out, with your active program, these five different themes, broadly speaking, which the first one would be to say stop segregating by age, right? Which we touched on earlier, which is 17-year-olds only hanging out with 17-year-olds. You know, that's something that kind of recent in human history, right?
Yes. I mean, if you brought people back from 300 years ago or 3,000 years ago, and you said, you know, what strikes you as weird about how we live, I don't think there's any doubt the first thing everyone would see from other times and places is just our material abundance, the sort of the material goods and just the cornucopia of stuff we have that most people have never had. When we look out at the world, we don't even see material versus natural anymore because our world just has so much material. And most people throughout most places in history would have just seen nature and not a lot of built stuff. Everyone would be shocked about how much material abundance we have. But I think 30 days after living among us, that would go away in people's sight. And the thing that would shock them is how generationally segregated we are. And as a dad of two teenage girls, I know that 13-year-old girl's slight of a 13-year-old girl or 15-year-old of a 15-year-old, it can hurt. But it turns out if you know 60-year-olds and 75-year-olds and 90-year-olds, the sting of that goes away really fast when you have the wisdom of somebody who's been through a war or lost a spouse or gone through a hardship and persevered and survived and built something special. Like, you need the wisdom of generations to grow up well and not to just be obsessed with the moment you're living in of that particular second. There's a sort of narcissism that's natural about being a teenager. You got tons of vitality and your frontal lobe isn't fully formed yet for self-restraint and self-control. But you need the wisdom of multi-generational experiences. And we need to build that for our kids because our age screams segregate to the marketing demographic segment that TV's trying to sell you stuff with. And it's not healthy for our kids.
Mm-hmm. I want to briefly skip over the other couple stages, and because we touched on them at odd points in the course of the program. And I want to go to the fifth one, which is to become a truly literate person. And what do you mean by that?
I mean that our founders thought that literacy, not just functional literacy, but, you know, actual appetitive literacy, do I want to read? Do I read? Do I have those habits? Our founders thought that was a prerequisite to deliberative democracy. In a broken world, there's going to be control, right? Somebody's going to provide structure. And the question is whether we have self-control, self-restraint, self-governance, self-discipline, deferred gratification, or whether or not you get control and discipline from somebody else. And in the American experiment, we want a limited amount of government to maintain that framework for order and liberty, but not try to solve every problem by the powerful defining the good, the true, and the beautiful for the rest of us and what you must pursue as your form of happiness. But if you're going to have a society that has all that decentralization, a lot of self-control possibilities, then you have to have people who are actually able to make those decisions. And I think that Gutenberg is, more than any other person, the founder of the printing press, he is the true father of America. If you didn't have mass literacy, mass reading, a mass reading public, and therefore the sort of plurality of the printing press and the cultural pluralism that flowed from that, you wouldn't have had the American First Amendment with free speech, press, religion, assembly, protest. All the beating heart of the American experiment is sort of dependent upon a public that wants to read. Well, it turns out we don't have that right now. The average American is reading about 19 minutes a day, but it skews with age such that older people read on average much more than 19 minutes and younger people much less than 19 minutes. And that creates a kind of immediacy in the way we think and the way we deliberate or don't, the way we merely sort of emote, and in the ways ultimately that you sort of consume media and what you think is newsworthy and important and durable for the long term in your worldview. And right now, I think that there's a real risk as we transition to a digital culture. And by the way, I'm a big zealous proponent of a lot of what the digital economy will bring. I think I'm no Luddite. I believe there'll be huge economic upswings on net because of the digitization of the economy we're going through. But I don't think it's at all obvious that the benefits will redound to the median household and to the median family unless we cultivate all of the things that you need if you're going to have mass distributed power. And that requires a kind of literary appetite. And by that, I don't mean everybody has to love high culture, but I mean it does mean that people have to be curious and they have to believe in self-resilience. And the fact that when the economy leads 40 and 45 and 50-year-olds to get disrupted out of jobs and firms, we have to believe that our people are not just lifelong learners in theory, but have the potential to actually get retrained for a new job and have the social network and the human capital to be able to be resilient enough to get reemployed at age 45 or 50 when they get disrupted, because there's never been a civilization that's gone through the kind of economic disruptions that we're likely going to go through in the future. That's what I mean by creating a literary appetite in our folks.
And so Senator, kind of bridging from that, the literary mindset, kind of explain what you talk about in the book about the 5-foot shelf and the books and things that you are trying to introduce to your kids. And you talked about how it's not books that you're just going to read once. It's books that they're going to read and then want to come back to, and kind of explain how that works. And then, we'll kind of wrap that up, and we got one more question for you, but we want to talk, but I thought this was really interesting, so I'd like you to kind of expand upon that.
So I think we're impoverished in the sense that we don't have a shared canon anymore. We don't have clarity about, 200 really important books that all Americans have read together. And some of the debates in the 1980s in particular that led to the demise of the canon, some of them are important debates. Lots of them, though, aren't. There's a lot of identity politics that leads to an attack on any sense that we have should have a shared reading list. Instead of picking that fight directly, because I don't think it's soluble anytime in the near term, I care about the actual experience of American families to try to create a shared reading list in their home and with their neighbors and in their local community. And so my wife and I went through this experiment where we said, just pretend that the average book's about an inch wide, a 5-foot shelf will hold 60 books. What if we wanted to create a list of 60 books that we wanted our kids to have started to tackle by the time they left high school and went off to college or work or wherever they go in their late teens for a time moving out of our household? What if they've started to tackle it, but also have a shared sense of this is an important list, this is an important shelf of books that they want to work through over the course of a lifetime? And so we tried to distinguish between quality and quantity in the cultivation of our kids' appetites. ultimately, we want to parent with the grain whenever we can. And so if our kids as 6-year-olds or 8-year-olds or 10-year-olds fell in love with, you know, the Hardy Boys or Encyclopedia Brown or, you know, Magic Treehouse, we wanted to first just double down on affirming the fact that they wanted to be readers and figure out the way to, you know, praise them and reward them and sort of reaffirm that self-identity as readers. And then once they had the habit, once they had the bug of reading, we started to substitute more and more quality for the quantity. And so it would be like, you picked a book, great. Now on the next one, that was kind of an ice cream book you picked. We're now going to give you a choice between asparagus and broccoli and spinach. We're not going to just command exactly what you read next, but this next one's going to be a little meatier for your development and your diet than just, you know, Magic Treehouse. And so we got into a phase of trying to upgrade their reading, and we played a game called the Century Club, which, by the way, none of my kids have succeeded at yet. We don't hold our kids out or our family out as a model in this book. My wife and I just have a shared theory of what we're trying to accomplish. We stumble and fall every day, but we're rowing on oars in the same direction. And so we created this, or we borrowed this game from a guy named Tevi Troy, where we try to have our kids aspire to read 100 books in a year. Most anybody can read 2 books a week in August on vacation or something. But to try to get to a place where you're reading enough that you have a shot at reading 2 books a week for an entire year, it's a pretty great aspiration. And so we let our kids read stuff that may have had more of a cotton candy flavor at the beginning. Again, just sort of parenting with the grain of what they like to read. But then we started pushing into that equation a lot more stuff that was higher quality. And so we went through this exercise of showing, as we construct our list of 60 great books, here's how we're going to do it. Join with us. And to the degree that people want to argue with this chapter of the book, I think we've been successful. Because what I want people to do is have their own list of 60 books. I think there are better and worse things to put on your list. But what I really care about is people wanting to create a list of books that they return to again and again as a family.
Oh, that's great. Well, Senator, thank you very much for taking the time out to join us. We do have one more question for you.
Indeed we do, Senator. We ask all our guests a gotcha question, and it's a matter of vital cultural importance. You should know Jay and I disagree very strongly on this question, so no matter what, you will be disappointing.
Thanks, somebody, Matt.
You're gonna be disappointing someone, but Senator, I think that's liberating. So here's the question.
Fire.
Here's the question. Is the television show Seinfeld overrated?
Wow, that would require us to come up with a shared sense of how highly it's thought of. The thing that pains me, as somebody who doesn't really watch TV, I watch live sports, and that's about it. Seinfeld was the last program we ever really watched. I think it went off the air in what, 98?
Yes.
Ish. And it was on for 10, 11 years probably.
Right. Yeah.
Which means it's been off almost twice as long as it's been on, or as it was on. That's amazing. So I don't even know how to benchmark what general pop culture thinks of it. But as a huge Seinfeld fan, I'm going to have to say it's underrated.
Oh, yes. Just so you know, obviously who you made happy with that answer. So, but that's great.
But that's okay, Senator. We're still going to recommend your book, Vanishing American Adult, Our Coming of Age Crisis, and How to Rebuild a Culture of Self-Reliance.
Well, Senator, thanks again so much for joining us. We really appreciate it. I know you're a busy man, and you know, so that the taking that little bit of time out is great.
Thanks for having me on. I appreciate you guys.
All right, I
follow you both online. I don't listen to the podcast enough, but I'll do it more.
I appreciate that as well.
Fantastic.
All right, thanks, Senator. Take care.
See you guys.
All right, Senator Ben Sasse. There, that was an interesting conversation.
Yeah, that was really great.
Yeah, it was. It was.
Everybody should go out and jump on Amazon. You know, we'll
buy
put the
book.
Amazon link.
We'll
in
put the link
show
there.
Notes.
Yes, we will.
And all our loyal listeners will go out and buy it, of course.
Right, and if you're somebody who likes listening to Senator Sasse speak, he actually is the one who, if you buy the audio version, he's the one that reads it. So it's a double shot if you want.
He is great. And one of the things about this book, just to kind of take us into the closing here, is that a friend of mine happens to be the chaplain for the Nebraska State Patrol, and a couple years ago, he told me, watch this guy, Ben Sasse, because he's the real deal. I had never heard of Ben Sasse. And so 2 years later, I had heard of Ben Sasse. And it, as it turns out, yes, he is indeed the real deal. He's not writing this typical politician's book. It's not just, right, you know, like you said, wrap yourself in the flag and come up with some anodyne policy prescriptions. He's trying to tackle some very serious issues here. And so I'm really glad we got a chance to talk to him about it.
Yeah. And again, like also, again, doing it in a way where he's not necessarily saying, hey, this is how it's done. We've nailed it. We figured it out. And he talked about how, you know, we stumble, we fall. We're not necessarily always going to get it correct. But, you know, this is the framework that we're using. And you know, so, you know, I think I think basically for what he's saying is, if I can get somebody to think differently about what they're doing, that's great. That doesn't necessarily have to be you do it the way I do it or else.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly.
All right. Well, that is going to do it for this episode. We will see you next time here. And I'm Jake Russo for Neil Dewing. We'll see you next time here on The Fifth Estate.